putting current flowing through the ground lead, the so-called safety lead, in the wiring of the hospital. You now can develop millivolts or volts of difference between what you think is ground in room number one versus room number three, and that voltage is that appears across the catheter, and in some cases it only takes millivolts that can give you damage when you're doing a catheterization of the heart. You've got to worry about very minor things there. So there's a kind of grounding loop where what you think is ground, and your ohmmeter will confirm it, but still there is a method by which potential voltage differences that are beyond the threshold of alarm could take place. So the word ground loop has got a whole bunch of meanings. I've just given you two of them off the top of my head, if you know what I mean. So even though they're all going to the same place, and your ohmmeter says they're all going there with great integrity, you've got to look at the physical layout of the wiring and other things that can be drawing current and whatever. There's more to it than first meets the eye. It's about the easiest way I can put it.
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
So you haven't got the whole story, but you got a little bit more of the story here, Bernie. K2 Mike Uniform. And I'm trying to think of, you used something funny this morning. K2, you used
his uncle.
There it is, Murky's uncle. K2 Murky's uncle. K2 IW, you got a brain.
And KC2, QIQ with a comment on ground loops.
We're going to go to you right after Bernie. Bernie first.
Okay, way cool. Oh, I forgot the beep there. Wow, okay. Yeah, Monkey's uncle. Actually, I'm the monkey, but close enough. Great on the ground loop thing. At least I have a little bit of an idea of what Glenn was referring to. Also, if you could just comment briefly on the phenomenon of making that electrical ground and making a big difference in RF reception.
You're going to hear a lot of opinions on that one, Bernie. There's a zillion guys out there who have television interference or some other thing that they're not happy with the operation of the ham radio equipment. And lots of people have come up with a theory that if you create a greater ground on your equipment, the television interference will go away. 98% of the time, I think it's not going to happen. Yeah, you've made a change to the system, and maybe it helps the ground, the television interference, but most of our antennas are internally counterpoised. In other words, if I've got a real dipole out in the air with the right kind of a balancing device between the transmission line and the dipole, at one instant of time, my transmitter is issuing a signal. The end of the transmission line is coupling a signal into the dipole such that on this half cycle, I'm driving the right-hand side of the dipole with positive voltage and the left-hand side of the dipole with negative voltage. It's thoroughly balanced. So the real action is taking place between right side and left side. Each half of the dipole is the counterpoise for the other half. The circuit is complete. And whether or not 100 feet away at the input end of the transmission line in the shack, whether or not that equipment is grounded doesn't make a darn bit of difference in that example. But now if I do something like a NFED ZEP antenna, where I've got a simple straight piece of wire out in the air, and I'm feeding it at one end, and now depending on how I connect that coax cable to that one end, and depending on whether or not I ground the bottom end of that transmission line, now the counterpoise of that antenna is in the shack. By counterpoise, I mean, what do you push against? To use the example I often use, let me drop. Assume Arnold Schwarzenegger is floating in the cargo hold of the space shuttle in space, in orbit. He's in weightlessness. Assume he weighs 200 pounds, and he's got a 200-pound barbell in his hand. He pushes the barbell 1 meter per second to the north. His body will move 1 meter per second to the south. Action and reaction. The barbell is the antenna. His body is the counterpoise. You've got to push against something. In the case of the dipole, you're pushing the right-hand side versus the left-hand side. It's automatically counterpoised. But in the case of something like an unbalanced antenna, an improperly installed ground plane or an NFED ZEP, now you're pushing against something else, which is the coax cable and the grounding of it in the shack, And so now grounding will make a difference. But my recommendation is you don't use unbalanced antennas. There's a whole lot of balance, whole lot of advantage in using balanced antennas that represent their own counterpoise. Okay, Glenn, tell us your latest theory on ground loops and lightning projection. KC2QIQ, K2LAW.
Yeah, good evening, Vic. I just wanted to take a couple of steps back and talk about ground loops and what they are. It's actually a very, very simple analysis and to understand what a ground loop really is. And I'd like to spend a little bit of time and talk about this because I think it's highly misunderstood by so many people. But it's very, very important not only for house wiring, the layout of a PC board. If anybody wants to lay out a PC board, or wiring systems and system wiring, and what actually makes a ground loop and why is it problematic. Let this drop for a second, and let me start my description. Okay, what a ground loop is, it basically, imagine we have, let's start off with three circuits. We've got three batteries, three resistors, and three sets of connection cables. So we have three independent circuits that are only wired individually. Battery one connects to resistor number one with wire set number one, a plus wire and a minus wire coming back. So we've got three independent circuits, and each one of them operates completely on their own. So the resistor one gets heated by battery number one, the second resistor by battery two, the third one by battery three. None of the circuits cross each other. None of them have anything to do with each other. Now we're going to make a modification to that circuit. We're going to start taking the minus wires and we're going to interconnect them. And so that now the minus wires, all the three batteries get tied together. Now that those three grounds are tied together, or even just two of them for that matter, you wind up with a ground loop. What's actually happening now is that the return wires are now sharing a same common point. Let me let this drop. Dick, just for a comment before I go any further, am I making sense so far, or did I lose anybody?
You're doing very well. Please proceed.
Well, what actually happens is when we have all these wires connected with three separate loops and three separate circuits, and we attach the ground points together, we're not really causing a heck of a lot of harm at that point because the wires were already pretty well defined, and the circuits were basically completed by the existing wires. But now what can happen is you can wind up with a situation where when the ground wires are being shared by, so in other words, we have three separate loops of current, and they could basically be replaced by one small piece of wire between the three circuits. And now what will happen is you've got three sets of loop currents now sharing one wire. So what's happening is that one wire now is sharing three sets of currents in one piece of wire. So you can basically see that they're sharing. And in that particular case, as long as that wire is heavy enough engaged to handle the three sets of loop currents, it's probably okay. Where it starts getting complicated is when we start using AC signals, like radio frequency and other problems. What can happen is those loop currents now start sharing. They could be RF signals mixing with power supply signals and other things on the ground wire return. So what's happening is instead of having a nice, clean DC return path, you get some RF on it. So now what's happening is the current from one of the circuits starts interfering with another circuit. So far, Dick, let me just see if there's any questions or if anybody understands it so far from there. KC2QIQ.
I think one example might be if the three circuits are daisy-chained such that because you've now shared some of the wiring, like the grounding wiring is part of the daisy chain, now as item number three, furthest downrange, draws more and less current because it's a load that's not fixed, the voltage drop in the wiring in circuit number one and circuit number two could be modulated. When you're using real fancy op-amp circuits, which are sensitive to millivolts and microvolts, the very small difference in voltage drop in the common wire between the power supply and circuit number one versus the variation in current going all the way downrange in the daisy chain to number three means that now some of the voltage to circuit number one is being modulated by the current drain variation of circuit number three. That's what might happen in the daisy chain, which is slightly related to what I think you're talking about, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LAW.
Absolutely, Dick. And that's exactly very, very well spoken, and I love the way you're explaining it, too, because what's really happening there is whenever you have multiple circuits, in other words, three separate supplies, three separate circuits, and three separate sets of currents running down one wire, and they start sharing that same ground, the signals start to mix. Now, one of the ways of curing this is what they call the single point ground. What you can do is if you have three batteries and three load resistors, you can take a very, very fat metal plate or a huge ground plane and ground all the batteries, all three batteries or the three power sources right to a huge plate so that everything that's going to have that ground return is attached to this huge, huge ground plane so that all the only wires that are running to those individual loads are the positive wires going from each individual signal source or each battery to each resistor. And when they're sharing a big fat ground plate or a large ground plane, the circuits can basically mix, but the voltage drops in a very, very large ground plate or a ground plane are very, very small. So the interference currents don't really make big voltage drops to cause interference with the individual circuits. So ground loops in very, very fat, thick ground planes tend not to be much of a problem. But when we have small wires that are interconnected, where, in other words, one wire from one circuit starts getting daisy-chained over onto another circuit, you can definitely have currents running through one wire that start mixing signals. And it's that mixing of signals across individual wires that can cause problems. Let me let it drop for a second. Now, getting back to wiring grounds in a house. In a house, most of the house, it doesn't have a very, very large ground plate underneath the bottom. You know, your house is mostly a wood frame, and basically most of your house is really dielectric. So the only real grounding that you can do is your electrical panel ground, and if you're trying to do lightning protection on the outside of the house, you put your ground rod on the outside of the house and you attach it up to your antenna structure. Now, the idea behind separating the grounds is basically keeping them separate so that you don't have a ground loop from the lightning that would go into a ground rod on the outside of the house and share that with the grounding system inside the house. So when I'm talking about ground loops in that particular application, I'm trying to keep the lightning grounds on the outside of the living structure and the basically electrical safety grounds separated on the inside of the house so that they don't share the same currents and the same for the same loops. Dick, back to you. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
And when Glenn was talking about using a wide, flat metal plate as the common point of grounding for the three separate circuits, because that wide, flat plate, which maybe is one of the layers of a multi-layer printed circuit board, in theory it could have micro-ohms or nano-ohms of difference between the various points of contact, whereas ordinary 26-gauge wire would have milliohms, so therefore the amount of signal that gets cross-coupled could be orders of magnitude different, depending on the flat plate versus the wiring. One other thing to know about is that when you sink a EIA standard ground rod in the ground, 8-foot-long piece of steel, galvanized on the outside, or copper, 5/8 diameter, as I said, it's 8 feet long, and you sink it below ground grade, and you put a piece of 6-gauge wire to it to the thing you want grounded, install a series of those properly and measure the resistance between them. You might measure an ohm on a really good day. A standard lightning bolt, if you ever take a direct hit, can easily be 11,000 amperes. 11,000 amperes flowing into that ground rod, which has 1 ohm of resistance to the rest of planet Earth. 1 ohm and 11,000 amperes is 11,000 volts. The thing you call ground rod, and the worst case lightning bolt, everything on that circuit, the tower, the antenna, and the 6-gauge wire going to that ground rod, that whole thing in a direct strike could suddenly become 11,000 volts above ground. Does that give you a little bit of an idea of what could happen on a direct strike? No matter what you do to protect yourself from a direct strike, you're going to suffer some damage. What we're trying to do is eliminate the damage, and for 99% of the time, you don't take a direct strike. Something else in the neighborhood, the
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
99% of the time, the LOCO and Con Ed wiring in the neighborhood is tremendously more extensive than your antennas and your tower and whatever. Even though you think it's the biggest chunk of beautiful metal around, the lightning looks at all those other pieces of metal, and there's a 99% chance they're going to hit them and not you. So 99% of the time, you don't get a direct strike. You get a very indirect strike, and the electromagnetic pulse nearby gives you some grief. But in the case of a direct strike, the way you do grounding, once you realize the kinds of voltages that can occur across the circuits that you call ground, is quite humbling at times. You might have some further comment on this, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
WA2SAY.
Doug recognized, but Glenn first. Go ahead, Glenn.
That's very well stated, Dick, and exactly. I mean, if you have a true total breakdown with a total direct strike, nothing's going to really, you know, really help. But there are some other things. One thing is that certainly by adding the ground rods on the outside of your house, you're trying to keep the current path outside the living structure. It's certainly a help. And in most cases, it'll handle surges and static buildup and other problems that are related to antennas, that keeping that ground rod on the outside of the house is certainly a much better way to go for lightning protection and surge protection and other things in your antenna system. The other thing that's important to know, too, is that they do make surge protectors, but the location of a surge protector is very important. When the coaxial feed lines and antenna lines come in to enter your living area, your living quarters, in other words, your antenna's up on the roof someplace and your feed line is feeding in, the best location to put a surge protector is right at the entry point where your coaxial cable or your balanced feed line or whatever it is feeding into your house. Right at that point, right there, and if you can attach your surge protector to a ground rod outside the house, right where the surge protector is, and just entering the area, is going to be much more effective than putting the surge protector inside your house near your test equipment or your transceiver or other equipment. Dick, back to you. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Thank you for all that information, Glenn. Doug, the B2SAY, what do the guys out east do to protect themselves from lightning? You got it, Doug.
Well, I don't know what the guys out east do to protect themselves from lightning, but I had a couple of comments here. I guess the main one is the idea of having a ground rod outside your house and an electrical ground inside the house and not being connected. I think it's a violation of the electrical code. I believe, now unless they have changed it, that the electrical code requires that your antenna ground be connected, physically connected with a wire, probably like a number six gauge or something like that, to your electrical ground in the house, to the wherever the ground rod for the AC power comes into the house. I believe that's supposed to be connected. I actually have a question about that, whether you can run the connection through your basement for the most direct connection or whether you have to run it around the outside of the house so that it's not inside the house or what, I don't know. Unless they have changed the code, I'm almost certain that you are intended to keep the two grounds physically, electrically connected with a piece of wire, not just ground, not just earth, between the two grounds. I would welcome any comment from anybody that's an expert on that. WA2SAY, back to that.
KC2, QIQ with a comment.
Yeah, I was going to turn it over to Glenn. Doug, your audio is about 8 dB lower than I think it should be, so you could crank up that audio a little bit or shout into that microphone. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, with regard to the electrical code, and depending on what your location is, in most areas, there are different electrical codes. There's electrical codes for industrial type applications, there's residential type of wiring, and different types of codes. So depending on the code that you're going, they work in sets. So in other words, it depends on the location of the facility and what the grounding structure is. In a residential structure where you have like a tripod on your roof, the antenna structure in your backyard, and you have what's called local lightning grounding at that end of the structure, the standalone ground of the antenna stands and does not have to be attached back to the mains of your power line. Although your cable system has to be, your telephone system has to be, and your electrical panel must be attached to that one ground point inside the house. But in residential, it's not a requirement for your outside amateur radio antennas to be returned back to that ground. If you're in an industrial situation where you're in a building that has a centralized ground plane like superstructure and other points like that, then you must return those grounds back to the substructure ground of that facility. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, thank you, Glenn. I believe we've gone down the list of the people who signed in. If not, somebody's going to let me know real fast. I think it's time we go over to John's mailbag. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick. Everyone on the net. All right. Let's see. We have a gentleman who's confused about some terms. He seems to understand passband, bandpass, and bandspread. But he is very confused about... Oh, this is going to be fun here. Let me see. I'm going to make sure I get the right one. All right. He wants to know the television signal. What is the baseband? What is it referred to? And what actually is it? Back to you, Dick.
Okay. Back in the days of analog television, even then it wasn't clear. The best example of the word baseband really being used, you can look at the diagram that's in the August issue way back in 1972, QST Magazine, an article by K2RIW called Houston, This is Apollo. And I was talking about the command service module signal on Apollo 15 that I was listening to. That signal coming down from the electronics on the Apollo module was on a frequency of 2287.5 megacycles. That was the carrier. On that carrier were some extra tones inserted. One of the tones was roughly 1 megacycle. One of the tones was roughly 1.5 megacycles. So you got a tone on the carrier, 2 separate tones, 1 megacycle and 1.5 megacycles. Now, on each one of the tones, additional modulation was added, which gave you telemetry, biomedical, battery, astronaut audio, and so on. So in other words, the astronaut audio was a modulation on top of a subcarrier. The subcarrier was put onto the main carrier. So it was a FM-PM telemetry system. FM modulation was astronaut audio, put on a phase-modulated subcarrier, put on the main carrier, 2287.5. Where in that case is the baseband? Maybe it's not a good example. Baseband. Hey, John, give me your first guess as to what the word baseband means to you. I think it's got more than one meaning. But
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Maybe we should also use the example of Muzak radio, which is a separate subcarrier on your FM broadcast signal, which gives you the background music, which is really on a subcarrier of the main FM broadcast. Your QXR probably has some Muzak at one time. So QXR, I think, was on 91.7 or something like that. That's the main carrier frequency. A 67 subcarrier frequency was inserted on that, which is ultrasonic. You didn't hear it. But on it was Muzak audio was superimposed on it. And the same thing with the stereo. I didn't give a very good answer on this one, John. KC2WGB, maybe you could help K2RIW.
Well, I'm sure we could dig Eric up, and he would know. Here's how I look at it. I like to keep it simple. On a simple radio transmission, I look at the baseband as the original carrier. But now, as you stated, when we start adding 2 and 3 other products of information, each one of those has a baseband which is riding on the primary baseband. So that is a confusing thing, and it's a great question. Maybe Eric's out there and he could help us out. KC2WGB. But that's the way I look at it.
Yeah, the broadcast people use terms like that. And Eric is the best thing we can get a hold of, a real broadcast engineer with lots of years of experience. Let's see if Eric's available. KE2EJ, if you're out there. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Give me a second, I'll get to a good radio.
Roger Dodger.
You mean he has one?
Yeah, but he saves it for occasions of state.
Just trying to impress his dick.
K2RIW, KE2EJ.
You sound good, Eric. Go right ahead. A little bit of tone in the background from feedback, but you sound good.
All right. What was the question?
The questioner on John's mailbag was, what is the real meaning of baseband? In the case of radio transmission, what does baseband mean?
All right. The way we look at it, baseband is, in terms of RF, is whatever the signal is that we're going to put on the RF, whatever the intelligence is, that's going to be carried by our, whether it's a carrier wave or a pulse or whatever it is. So in the terms of television, we call the video signal baseband, or the actual originating signal, and the modulated signal or carrier modulated AM and FM, that's the actual transmission. So broad baseband is before modulation, before carrier, the information that originates to be sent somewhere else.
Okay, I'm getting the picture. If you had an extremely simple video camera system, the video coming out of that cable of the camera is baseband video. That in turn goes into a kind of a modulator, which is part of the transmitter, and then the signal gets superimposed on the RF carrier. So the baseband is the, in that case, is the video coming out of the video camera. Is that close to true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Yeah, that's the way we look at it. It applies to information that needs to be brought to some other place. The method of transport is the actual carrier signal, or the device that sends the information to somewhere. So we consider the non-RF portion of the signal, which has the intelligence, to be the baseband. That could also be applied to microwave, whereas the baseband signal sent to the microwave might actually be a data signal. It could also be something that is at an IF frequency, believe it or not, where we may multiplex stuff together, dump it into 70 megahertz, and put that into a microwave transmitter, and the same thing goes for satellite. The baseband signal is the signal that is sent to either the up converter or the modulator before it gets to the satellite.
Yeah, part of what's going on here is that when you're up at a high enough frequency that we all call radio, and if it's connected to the right kind of a electromagnetic transducer, which is called antenna, that radio signal, you can transmit it into the air, and it'll go a significant number of miles most of the time and be picked up by another antenna called the receiving antenna, and now that carrier wave, that radio wave, gets there. That's the good news, but it doesn't contain intelligence. You could take that signal coming out of the camera, the video signal, connect it to an antenna, because it's so much lower in frequency, and because the antenna is not resonant at that frequency, that signal will be propagated in air some number of inches or a couple of feet. It ain't going to go miles. So you can't put the signal directly to the antenna. The antenna itself will carry the radio signal for a lot of miles, but the radio signal doesn't have the information on it. So you've got to mix the two together. So now your radio signal is either going to be angular modulated, which is FM or phase modulation, or amplitude modulated, in accordance with the so-called baseband video. the video coming out of that camera. So the video coming out of the camera gets superimposed on that radio carrier, and now the two will go through the air and a large number of miles. So that helps a little bit, maybe. KC2WGB, K2RAW.
Let me add a little bit to that.
Another question while you're at it, Eric. Now, when we have the audio being transmitted, is that within the same baseband, or is that a separate baseband? Nick, back to you.
You got it, Eric.
Actually, that's where I was going to go. Traditionally, in an FM broadcast station, you have audio. But you not only have audio, you have a pilot. You also have some subcarriers that give you stereo. That combination signal before it hits the transmitter is considered to be the baseband. If it was an FM mono transmitter, the audio signal going to the transmitter would also be considered the baseband. Baseband is kind of a broad term, but that's the stuff with the intelligence before it gets to the transmitter. That's sort of the general definition of it. It could be just simply audio. It could be audio plus subcarrier. It could be video. It could be data.
Okay, good sound. Good stuff, Eric. Go ahead, John.
Great answers. Okay. Oh, here's one, Dick. Maybe you've done this, but I never even thought of this. All right. This gentleman has two rotors, and he wants to sync them up in a way he can use one controller and keep them locked in azimuth movement. What do you think of that? And how would he go about it, if it's possible?
Now, that depends on what accuracy he's needing. If he's got a rotor going to antenna number one and a rotor going to antenna number two, and as each one of those azimuth rotating rotors operate, if you want to keep the two antennas at every instant of time aimed in the same direction to the nearest 5 degrees, then a pair of HAM-Ms would do that. Periodically, you'd go all the way around to full clockwise or full counterclockwise to make sure they're in synchronization. And within 5 or so degrees, as long as you give them the exact same command and they're running 120 microfarad, is it 120 microfarad capacitor, AC electrolytic capacitor is in good shape, they will turn together. Occasionally, they're going to slip a little bit. If you want to absolutely positively guarantee that they move together, then you're going to put a chain drive between them with a great big sprocket reel. Another way you could do it is electronically. Assuming you've got good integrity of the potentiometer, which indicates where the antenna is aimed, that's the thing that normally comes down to the meter movement, the galvanometer in the shack that indicates where the antenna is. As long as that circuit is working correctly, there are ways you could electronically sense where antenna number one is, and that in turn would give a series of commands to rotator number two to make sure they're always synchronized. So it's a function of how elaborate you want to be, how much accuracy you need. Obviously, the most accurate is a chain drive between the two, which doesn't slip, and now you're guaranteed that they move together. Those are some of the ways it could be done. KC2WGB, K2RAW.
Just stepper motors.
Okay, stepper motor is another good way. Yes, a high-quality set of stepper motors, every time you give it a step, it moves a very specific amount. And so now you don't even have to worry about is one rotator a little bit heavier loaded than the other, and therefore they go out of track. So stepper motors is another very good way. And there's a modern equivalent of stepper motors, which is called the brushless DC motor. A brushless DC motor is, to some degree, being used like a stepper motor, a high-speed analog-like stepper motor. And my goodness, do they work very well with good circuitry. KC2WGB, K2RAW.
You know, brushless DC motors require feedback for accuracy.
I accept that. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick. Yeah, they could do it with encoders, too. I mean, if you really want to get elaborate. But I'm just wondering, would one control unit be able to drive two motors? What do you think about that?
There's an extremely weak, extremely low audio signal that has tried to break in twice, but we're not able to hear your call letters. Yeah, it is possible to use one controller to control more than one rotator. Would you just simply hook them up in parallel and pray? No, you better study the circuitry a little bit more. You're going to be overstressing the transformer inside and so on. If you're willing to modify it, you could make one controller control two, particularly if it was done as a stepper motor. But to just dumbly go and do it, I think the chances of success are not extremely good, John. What's your guess as to what he's trying to do? Make two antennas track each other? KC2WGB, K2RIW?
Yes, Dick, he has two antennas that are separated approximately 15 feet, and they're both Yagis, six-element Yagis, and for some reason he wants them to turn in unison, and it would be difficult to use a chain, but I think he's going to have a problem there. Now, maybe if he wired his rotor control unit with a set of relays, but then they wouldn't turn in unison. One would turn, then it would switch over and turn the other one and bring it to the same azimuth. That would be possible. But other than that, I think he's going to have difficulty there.
Yeah, this really is a servo mechanism problem. And there are various techniques of making a pair of servo mechanisms track each other with electronic feedback. So there are classic circuits that'll do that. Simply go out and buy a Ham M, a Cornell Dubilier, or what's the other popular brand name? What was that again?
Alliance.
Alliance. What's another popular brand of amateur rotator?
The Channel Masters, but that's really TV stuff. I have the Ham stuff.
Yeah, there's another very popular Ham brand that I can't think of right now.
Yaesu?
Yaesu, that's it. So Yaesu rotator, if you just take any of those popular rotators and you hook two of them in parallel to one control head, I don't think it's going to work very well without modification, circuit modification. The best I could recommend is to use the galvanometer feedback circuit in order to give commands to the other rotator. Either that or if your left hand is controlling the left hand rotator and your right hand is controlling the right hand rotator, and if you the human being are properly synchronized, you can do a pretty good job, in my opinion. Now there's another problem going on here. The main reason why you'd have two antennas tracking each other is you're doing the equivalent of building a phased array. When they're both aimed to the north and they're displaced east-west from each other, that's great. If you now want to listen to a signal to the northeast, and you aim them both to the northeast, and now you take the two signals out of the two antennas and combine them with some kind of a hybrid combining device before going into the radio, you've got a problem. Yeah, each antenna is aimed in the right direction, but the most right-hand antenna is going to see the signal coming from that northeast source. The signal is going to get to the right-hand antenna first before it gets to the left-hand antenna. That's a fancy way of saying the signal coming out of the right antenna will have a phase lead to it. And as such, without further electronic compensation for that physical displacement phenomenon, what is it now called? Point of earliest arrive? No. There's a fancy name for that kind of direction-finding system. So if the two antennas were on one common horizontal bar, and that bar was rotated from the center...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
DOA.
The two antennas are mounted on one solid horizontal bar, and that bar is rotated from the center, no problem. But with two completely independent antennas, you've got this extra compensation to take care of. BDA, BOA, something like that is what I think I heard. Go right ahead. Start off with your name and call letters if you haven't signed in earlier. K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
This is KO2OK. Were you looking for a TDOA?
That's it. TDO, time difference of arrival. So, yes, two thoroughly independent antennas. The right-hand antenna, in my example, when the signal is coming from the northeast, time difference of arrival. He's going to see the signal sooner, and so further electronic compensation is required for that to be a system that can sum the signals between the two antennas. So it can be done, but it's going to take some extra an extra figuring to make it come out right. Wonder if that makes some sense, John. KC2WGA? Here we go. KC2WG. Boy, I'm in great encore with it tonight here. KC2WGV. KQIIW. You know who you are.
I used to, but now you're confusing me. Well, what he could do is maybe take a belt of some kind and make an arrangement to gear the two control units so they move close to unison. But you're right, he will have a phasing problem once he gets into that attitude, and that would be 180 degrees either direction. But the other direction, he should do well. But he's got his work cut out for him. At least it's doable if he wants to put some work into it. KC2WGB.
Now, this is a classic problem, the time difference of arrival of signals on a great big field full of antennas. There are quite a few proposals and quite a few systems under construction or in use, which are something like a very large radio telescope that is built inside of, let's say, a 1 mile square of real estate, and you've got a whole bunch of individual dishes, and you're summing the signals from all of those dishes. You're building the equivalent of a 1 mile square radio telescope out of 100 or so individual dish antennas. And you can aim all of those dish antennas at that particular star, but they're not all going to sum in phase until you do some further compensation, knowing the geometry of the system. And because maybe the land is not super flat, some of the antennas are a little bit higher than the other. Depending on where you aim the dish, some of them get the signal sooner than others. All of that's got to be compensated if you want the signals to properly add together in order to get the benefit of this great big field of antennas. So lots of radio telescopes are doing that. It's called a phased array, a partially filled phased array. The National Radio Astronomy Observatory has got a minor version of one of those. A lot of that becomes academic. The problem all goes away when you build something like the so-called Great Big Telescope, the 100-meter dish that's at Green Bank, West Virginia right now. That's one huge dish that all moves together. And so there is no TDOA problem on that one. But now you've got another problem. You're taking something that's a couple of acres in area, and you're trying to move it in unison. And to make sure it doesn't develop a sagging errors and wind errors and everything else takes a lot of compensation. Let me drop. What they did in that case is to break the parabolic reflector into 2,600 individual pieces that are each a 1 or 2 meters square. And at the corner of each one of those, there is a corner reflector that's being viewed by way of a optical rangefinder at the focal point, at the feed horn. And the corners of each one of these 2,600 panels has a gear motor that can be used to crank that corner of the panel up and down so that this whole antenna continuously compensates for its accuracy of its parabolic dish as a function of temperature differences, gravity differences, wind load, snow load, and whatever. That dish, which ordinarily would only be useful up to about 3,000 megacycles, because of this compensating network built into it, is useful well beyond 100,000 megacycles, 100 gigahertz. Over to you, John, KC2 Washington George Bridge. That's what somebody gave you the call letters today, K2 Real Indian Woman. You got it, John.
That was K4NBC, by the way. That was cute. If you got time, I've got one more quick one.
Fire away.
Okay, this one I know you've got. This is right up your alley. Gentleman wants to know, what do they do and how do they select and what kind of materials to make a terminator, say 50 ohms or 75 ohms, whatever it is, work from PC to say 10 gigahertz. He knows there's stray capacitance, there's some inductance. How is that done, and what type of materials, and how accurate is it really done? So that's basically his question. Over to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Making a termination broadband and frequency response is primarily a problem of geometry. In the case of a very high power attenuator, a kilowatt dummy load, they do it by taper. In other words, the center conductor goes into the lossy material, starts off fairly small in diameter, slowly tapers to a larger and larger diameter as it goes to the far end of the termination, and it's got lossy material coated onto that center conductor and on the walls of the chamber that includes the termination. That's one approach, tapering. That's called the Minerva line. In case I might have coaxial cable at 50 ohms on this end of the bench, and I want to match it to 70 ohm termination at the other end of the bench. If I slowly taper the diameter of the semiconductor, inner or outer conductor, so that I slowly taper from 50 ohms to 70 ohms by changing the geometry, and if I change the geometry slow enough, it automatically becomes broadband. A man named Minerva wrote a series of articles on how to do that and the mathematics. That's one approach. Another approach is to just build the termination super small. If the physical dimensions of the termination are a thousandth of a wavelength in length and diameter, then as long as the material presents a 50-ohm load, there'll be essentially no frequency response. That's the good news. The bad news is building it physically small means that the termination is only good for a quarter of a watt, and you put a watt into it and you're going to burn it up. So you can't go too far with that one. There's a whole lot of techniques for doing it. And what you use as the terminating material is also very interesting. Let me drop this. If you look at a typical anechoic chamber, you'll see pyramid-shaped objects on the wall. Those pyramid-shaped objects are urethane foam, which has got a whole lot of flakes of carbon resistor, a whole lot of carbon granules built into the urethane foam. So urethane foam built in flat sheets makes a pretty good spatial termination if and only if you make it in 4, 5, or 6 individual sheets, and the individual sheets have different resistivities. You're slowly tapering from the high impedance at the end exposed to air, and the various sheets get lower and lower impedance until you get the short circuit at the back where there's a metallic coating. So you're slowly tapering the impedance. That's a spatial equivalent of a Minerva line. The pyramid technique means that a wave coming directly down the sharp point of the pyramid, a planar wave, make believe you've got a thin sheet of paper-like material, and you're bringing the piece of paper flat against those pyramids, you can envision the sharp point first piercing the piece of paper, and as the piece of paper progresses further and further into the material, the amount of piercing gets larger and larger. That's a fancy way of saying that the radio wave doesn't know it's been pierced by these tiny little points, and as it progresses down the sides of the pyramid material, it's slowly being tapered into a lower and lower impedance. So tapering is the main technique by which you get broadband high power frequency response of a either fixed termination on a transmission line or a spatial termination in a anechoic chamber. So geometry is the majority of the solution. KC2,
repeater, timeout, cancel.
KC2, Washington George Bridge, K2RIW.
KC2WGB, maybe I should get a vanity call, Dick. Great answers. A lot of fun. And a lot of good information. Oh, by the way, Dick, did you get the pictures I sent today?
I sure did. And those pictures on the screen are very complicated because your so-called simple circuit of your rheostat, wiring over to a L and a C, another wiring over to a termination. You've got significant amounts of wavelengths in between those components, and the rheostat itself changes its electrical length as you rotate it, and therefore, for those reasons, you've got very complicated pictures. I also saw that very nice spreadsheet where at each megacycle, so to speak, it tells you what the resistive component and the reactive component is. And the negative reactive component would be a capacitor, and the positive reactive component would be an inductor. So your machine, you can request that it will print out every megacycle, so to speak, what is the real impedance that you've connected to the end of that calibrated cable. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Okay, well, it looks like the machine is going to be a useful item, I hope. But I thought you'd appreciate those pictures, and now you know exactly what I was talking about with the three ports on each side with the two-channel input. So it looks like it's going to be all right. Okay, well, let's go back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Okay, I hope Paul is available. I think he did sign in earlier. WS2N, what has Curiosity been doing with its megawatt peak pulse power laser, which I think runs 45 watts of average power, and whatever. And how many feet has it traveled so far? WS2N, if you're there, Paul. K2RIW in the deck net.
Okay, WS2N. For the space part of the tech net. Yeah, Dick. Well, I think yesterday was, they took the day off just to take pictures and run some equipment. The sampling of Mars, you know, that unit built into the body, they inhale the air of Mars, and they run a test on that. They did that. But the day before, they ran 70 feet. So we'll see. This thing is really doing good. Pictures are really good. I saw a picture of Mount Sharp. You can see details of all the little hills and things that are sticking out of Mount Sharp. So that was pretty good. So I want to bring up a couple of other space topics. I know we really talked a lot about Curiosity, but that is the main focus lately. But there's other things going on with NASA. This is WS2N.
E3ZZ info.
I know, let me go back a couple of weeks, maybe 3-4 weeks, longer than that. Project called ERB, they had the, they ran a test with shooting a rocket. It was actually a sounding rocket. They went up, into space, you know, like 1,000 miles or something, and then they just brought it back without going into orbit. They were testing the new type of heat shield, and that's the one that they blow up. It's like a series of tires, each one getting bigger and bigger, except shaped like a cone. Had a big nitrogen charge in it, and when it got to outer space, this thing inflated, and they wanted to see how it was going to do with the heat. And, on re-entry, I think it was 10, 11 feet in diameter. So the first big test, really, of one of these things. They did one of the previous tests, but this was a bigger test. And you had brought up a question about an old movie called 2010 Space Odyssey. And you were wondering if they had some kind of inflatable device in front of these spacecraft when they, in the movie, when they wanted to deaccelerate going around Jupiter and drop it. The goal was to orbit Io. They wanted to go around one of their moons, but they needed to deaccelerate this 100,000 mile an hour speed, and they used aerobraking. And sure enough, this movie was on recently on Turner Classic Movie, so I recorded actually part of it at the very beginning of it, but they did have the part about the arrow breaking, and in the movie they call it Balut, B-A-L-L-U-T-E, shield, and sure enough, the whole front of this Russian spacecraft that they were in, you know, the American and Russian crew, inflated. I mean, it, this is huge. I mean, you're talking about, you know, maybe thousands of feet in diameter, serious gigantic airbags inflated. And that's exactly what they did. They turned the spacecraft into angled it toward toward Jupiter, and the thing gave off a tremendous amount of heat, you know, as you watch this thing go around Jupiter. And that's what they used. And at the end of the I mean, they were went halfway around Jupiter. Let me drop it.
And during that breaking sequence, Roy Scheider was in his bunk, and one of the Russian ladies was scared and jumped into the bunk with him during the breaking sequence. Do you remember that part of the movie, Paul? Go ahead.
That was pretty cool. And he didn't even know. Do you speak English? And she says no. I mean, you know, the whole crew would know each other before they got on board. I mean, well, they were put in suspended animation before they got to Jupiter. So I guess it's possible that they, you know, we'll let you know who's there when you wake up. But yeah, that was pretty cool. And they call it the Balut shield. And then after this thing deaccelerates, they break off. You know, you see these big airbags, what it looked like, just separate from the craft. So they had that idea way back when that movie was made, and Roy Scheider is very good. I know he's known for Jaws, but I always like him for that movie, Dick. I'll continue on with the space report, the real space report. The International Space Station has had a couple of EVAs recently, and the Russian part of the segment, they did an EVA, that was the 20th of August, and then the scheduled EVA was done by the American part, first time in a year, out of the Quest Lab. And they wanted to do a few things. They wanted to change the camera, broken camera on the Canadian arm, robotic arm. They never got around to doing that because they got involved with taking out this routing power supply thing. They call it a main bus power unit. And they show it's showing that it has problems. And they wanted to disconnect it and put a new one in. So they got the old one out. Now, this is a big thing. This weighs 250 pounds. And, you know, it's a big unit. It's got gigantic bolts to it. By eye, they look like three-quarter-inch rods holding this thing to the space station. Let me drop it. And they got this thing out. There's a woman. She's done like four or five EVAs and a Japanese astronaut. They took the old one out, secured that, and then they were going to put the new one in, and it didn't work out too good. Maybe the angle of it, they said, was wrong or whatever. And apparently, it looks like they stripped the threads. They couldn't bolt this thing properly. And they tried and tried. This was over an eight-hour spacewalk. So they gave up and regrouped. And now they plan on going out again the 5th of September to reattach this main bus power unit. There's four of them on board the station, and apparently they're very important. They route all the different power from the solar panels to the space station itself, WS1. So, you know, I got a kick out of it. I mean, NASA said that, well, it's showing that it might have a problem, but it really doesn't fail. And everything, you know, it seems to be working okay, but they decided, let's take it out, take a look at it, see what the story is. And it's kind of like the original 2001 movie. They had an antenna, the AE-35, you know, that was the whole story about that antenna. And the HAL 9000 computer wanted to go, you know, said it was failing, and because of it, they decided to go out and change it out anyway, just take a look at it. Meanwhile, there was really nothing wrong with it. And that's what this thing reminds me of. They're going out and changing something that might fail. They have three others on, you know, that work, but they want four operating. Before they came in, they secured it with some tether lines and straps and things. So we'll see how they do. If it doesn't work out on Wednesday, they plan on bringing the thing back eventually on another space, we'll back inside and so they can get a better look at what's going on to resecure this thing. But I was surprised at the diameter of bolts I saw on the internet. A couple of other topics, if you want to talk about this topic first, then back to you, WS.
Keep right on going, Bob. But let me take a quick break. We did have, I think it was KB2ZBZ. Somebody with a ZBZ wanted to make a comment. Who was that?
Victor Echo 3, Zulu Tango Zulu, Scott in Toronto.
Very fine, Scott. You're one of the furthest away, the most DX station that signed in tonight. Go right ahead with your comment, Scott. Victor Echo 3, Zulu Tango Zulu. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. This is the TechNet in New York, and you got it, Scott.
Yeah, first-time attendee caught wind of the net by listening to another net, so enjoying the content very much. Just a piece of info on curiosity. Here's the folks at NASA hid an Easter egg in the tire treads on Curiosity. That as it puts its way across the sandy soil and leaves its tread marks, the tread marks are actually Morse code. And there's a little bit of a mystery message in Morse code in Curiosity's treads.
Yeah, very fine. We have already discussed that one, Scott, believe it or not, the fact that the Morse code on the wheels taps out the JPL, Juliet Papa Lima, is what it cycles on each revolution. I don't know if all six wheels do it. I think only the wheels on the ends, the four corner wheels, do it. And so your audio sounds very good, Scott. I am curious, are you coming through by way of EchoLink or by way of IRLP? VE3ZTZK2RIW.
I am RF into the VA3, Victor Alpha 3, XPR repeater in Toronto, and IRLP to reflector 9126.
Very fine, Scott, and thank you for signing in. And, yeah, obviously there are ham radio operators involved in the Curiosity project, the Mars Science Laboratory project, to have pulled that off as JPL in Morse code, horizontally displaced across the surface of the wheel. So, in theory, when you look at the track that it leaves, by measuring the number of JPLs, you know the number of wheel rotations that you're looking at in that photograph of the tracks looking downrange. That's going to be a fun machine as it makes its future discoveries. Back to you, Paul, WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, very good. And yeah, and there was a report, actually, probably yesterday's Curiosity reported. They have, I think, different people doing it now and then, but this one guy, Babak Bernodi, I think his name is, has spelled down, let's see, F-D-R-D-O-W-S-I. This guy became popular, you know, with the media because he had his hair fuzzed off on the sides and didn't look like the typical NASA worker from 30, 40, 50 years ago. And, you know, everybody had the short blue shirts on, and this guy made the news because the way he looked, he's got all kinds of women trying to propose to this guy. But he's up on all this stuff, and he did one of the reports, and he just talked about that, I think it was yesterday, and showed the markings on the ground from Curiosity, you know, in one of the pictures with the JPL. And if you go to that, if you bring up the NASA site, you look for this guy's report. As he's talking, he talks about the CW on the wheels and drop it. Yeah, by the way, Dick, I saw it on all four tires, not the two metal tires, like you said. As he's talking, sure enough, you hear, you know, you hear the JPL, coming up as he's talking, you know, I got a big kick out of that, and, in the background. And then he says, look at the side of his head. Now he's on the side of his head, he's got the JPL, you know, and CW. Into his head. You know, when you look at the side of his head. So this guy's quite a character. So yeah, that's working really good. We drop it. Did something on, which I didn't know that they were going to do. They sent a song up to Curiosity, and then they had it played back. Some music, I don't know, about Mars or whatever it was. And it was the first transmission of a song from Mars. So, they do weird things like that, but I guess there's plenty of memory on board to do that. You know, there's no disk drives or anything, or tape drives. It's all done with flash memory. And they must have plenty of... They don't... So much memory, they don't know what to do with it all, I guess, right now. So they could erase everything as they want, and eventually put more programs in. They did that when they landed. They eliminated all. They deleted all the programs that they needed for descent and entry. And they didn't need that all that complicated information anymore. That's all gone. And then they used the memory for other stuff on how to